We're back today with part two with author Paul Connett discussing his book, The Zero Waste Solution. As he says, it's a move from the back end of waste disposal to the front end of resource management, better industrial design, and a post-consumerism way of life. Good shift of focus. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
And that's another aspect of zero waste. It's very, very positive. It's yes. It's yes to so many things. It's yes to recycling, composting, reuse, and repair. It's yes, yes, yes to community development. Yes, yes, yes to local jobs and local businesses and sustainable things. And this is very, very visible in Italy, which has not been known in the past to be very good on waste management. In fact, Italy has some of the worst waste management practices in the world, especially in the Naples area. But now we've got several hundred groups which are committed to zero waste, and it's become part of the Cinque Stelle movement in Italy, which in a very short time has got 140 seats in Parliament. Led by this crazy guy, Beppe Grillo, a former comedian on television before he said the wrong thing and they chucked him off. But he mobilized around the country. And basically what we're looking at with the zero waste movement is politics in action. Politics in action at the local level. And there was this magic moment when the groups which were attracted to what he was saying. I mean, he was organizing these big meetings of rallies, you know, 5,000, 10,000 people at a time. They would come out to hear him because he was so funny. He's like the Robin Williams of Italy. They would come to hear him make jokes, but in the middle of his program, he would introduce experts to talk about alternative energy and anti-GMOs and transport and then zero waste, and that's when I got involved. But he attracted a lot of followers in the country who called themselves amici di Beppe Grillo, friends of Beppe Grillo. And there was this magic moment when they went to Beppe and said, Beppe, how can we help you? What do you want us to do? And he says, I want you to go back to your communities and improve them. And this, to me, was a magic moment in Italian politics because hitherto, Italian politics is all talk, 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 talk. And there's nobody that can talk more and say less than an Italian politician. They're lovely people, but they just talk and talk and talk and talk. And for every Italian citizen, there's at least one political party. But now it's changed somewhat, at least in these zero waste communities where people are putting a lot of energy into improving their communities, moving in a sustainable direction, and they've latched onto this zero waste in a big way.
Paul, let's talk about some real concrete things that are being done right now. I think your whole vision of the university talking to each other, it reminds me of when my first daughter was in junior high and they revamped the program. So the history was going to relate to the math being learned and the history was going to relate to the geography and the cooking and all these other things. Are those kinds of programs, are you seeing them happen right now? And then maybe we can move into some specifics that you've seen in various communities that are just brilliant ideas that are working.
Well, I don't see them fast enough, quite frankly. We have got some zero waste research operations going on in Italy, but again, like everything else, it's very small scale, it's very local. The input from professors has been more virtual than local. I mean, we have quite a number of really good experts in Italy that are prepared to share their ideas and to get feedback on better industrial design. That is happening. And there have been steps in England, the University of Coventry, to get a zero-waste research operation, and working with a group in Wales, which I write about in the book called Cwmhari. Cwmhari is very much low-tech operation at a very small scale, but it's exciting attention. And they've introduced the notion of slow recycling, as echoing Italy's slow food movement. You do it slowly, you do it locally. This way you absolutely get very high quality materials for your local composting operation, and high quality materials for recycling. And the Welsh government has picked up on that, of the idea of slow recycling. And there's a company now there called Curbsort, which has a truck. The trucks that they use, the guys pick up the containers which the household has put together. They can put about 8 or 9 different recyclable items in this container, and these guys pick up the container, attach it to the side of the truck, and then they do the mini sort there at the truck's edge. So this combines the convenience for the citizen of putting everything into one container, but not the dreadful way it's now going on in the United States, where we have one container for all the recyclables, but they get mixed up and mashed up. So by the time they go through the separation plant, the quality is a bit low. So, yeah, I kind of got a little bit off your question there. I think my problem, and maybe this will change with the book coming out, I spend so much time with local communities educating, or trying to educate local communities about these ideas and inspire them to fight incinerators and go in the zero waste direction. Very little of my time is being spent these days in universities, unfortunately. So I'm not in the daily contact with professors as I once was, teaching at a university. Mm. So I'm pretty certain there are springing up around the country departments for sustainability. But there is a concern. You know, I remember back to my days when I was teaching at St. Lawrence University. When anything environmental came up, it was, oh, well, Paul, you're the environmentalist. What do you think of this? And after a while, I thought, hey, guys, you know, I'm not, just because I'm the environmentalist, that doesn't mean I'm the only academic that should be concerned about the environment. Whether you're a historian, whether you're a linguist, whether you're in English, whatever you're in, surely we all have a responsibility to the environment. And I think that's now even more acute. It should be, whatever our discipline is, whatever our skills are, surely we should all be interested and involved in sustainability. How can, and I would like universities to be doing this, just as we had teach-ins during the Vietnam peace movement, where the whole university would shut down for a day or two, and all our academic people and all the different disciplines would come together and discuss ending the Vietnam War. And obviously it was very divisive in some respects, but very cohesive in others. But I think we should be doing the same with sustainability.
Well, I'm excited hearing you speak like this. I know you mentioned, for instance, Eric Lombardi from Boulder EcoCycle in your book.
Yes.
And in Boulder, we also have Jack DeBell, who is in charge of the university's recycling. And he's brought that into the national forefront. I believe now he's on some kind of national committee, et cetera. As big government and big corporations fall and fail, it's so beautiful that what comes out of it and what grows out of it is true community starts really happening. So I can only imagine how slow it feels to you, as many things do feel slow in any kind of cleanup, organic or sustainable way. But there is some movement, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to approach this in both directions at once. I think some of the corporations are doing good things, and I mentioned some of them in the book. And those particularly pertain to the big corporations which are making durable goods like computers and copying machines and televisions, cars and things like that, where you can see how with good design these things can go round and round and round and not just be thrown away. I think the corporations which are problematic are the corporations which make money out of waste. I'd like to see them disappear. And the corporations which are involved in throw away, particularly throw away packaging, they will continue to be the villains. And yes, because we need to to localize, decentralize, and so on, some of the other corporations we have to question. But certainly, we need action at the grassroots level, yes, going up, providing as many of their services as we can. I mean, we need, in Italy, they're talking about the three zeros, or zero territories, where you have 0 kilometers, meaning you grow as much food within 70 kilometers as you can, 0 waste, which we've been talking about, and 0 emissions, decentralized energy production, wind and hydroelectric, small-scale hydroelectric, and so on. So, yes, there's room for both, I think, but in both directions, moving in both directions, large down, the small up.
Do you think that fracking could be clean, or is
no?
That... Okay.
No, I don't. I think that's another enormous thing that's caught up with us in a very, very short time, from what I can see of it, an absolute disaster, not least of which to the workers that have to work with these chemicals. I mean, I can't believe it. You know my background. I've been working for 17 years fighting fluoridation. Therefore, I've studied a lot about fluoride. And you don't have to study much about fluoride to realize that one of the most frightening and awful chemicals out there, and ask anybody in industry what it is, and it's hydrofluoric acid. It is absolutely horrendous material. And they're talking about pumping this hydrofluoric acid down in huge quantities to dissolve rock in order to release this oil, or whatever it is that they're releasing. And that is horrendous. And I've been talking to some medical people in Chicago area, medical people that have got involved in the fracking issue. And they're saying that these workers are getting very sick that are working in these. And they only reckon they can hang around in these companies for about 6 months before they get sick, and then the companies get rid of them. So fracking is absolutely horrendous in my view. And also chasing again, you know, whatever the merits of the technology, it's us searching for the wrong question. Mm-hmm. It's not squeezing every little bit of fossil fuel out of the Earth's crust that we should be chasing at the moment. It's to design lifestyles which dramatically reduce our demand for fossil fuel, and to look for elegance, to live within nature's system. And, you know, I once said, we have never invented a power station more elegant than a leaf on a tree. I mean, that leaf on a tree, think of what it does with all its trillions and zillions of brothers and sisters on our planet every day, harnessing the sun's energy, producing our crops, producing our food, fueling us, the leaf. So elegance is what we need. Elegance, creativity, removal of arrogance, be humble. A biochemist, I think anybody that does biochemistry must be struck by how incredible nature has been in constructing our living system. I mean, I think it would probably take something like the area of Texas of chemical equipment to produce all the chemistry that goes on in our bodies every day. And we do it at room temperature and at ambient pressures. This miracle called life. And we need to step back, and as some jurisdictions are doing, I remember meeting the Minister of the Environment in Schleswig-Holstein in Germany. He was a former professor of biology, and he says, before we design any solution, we look at the way nature. So we look at the way nature does it, whether we're talking about housing, whether we're talking about transport, whether we're talking about toxicity. We look at nature first to decide how we shape our solutions. Well, possibly a little bit of wishful thinking there, but that's what we need, that humbleness. And again, before I lose track of it, when I say we need everybody, I'm not just talking about engineers and economists and waste experts. I'm talking about musicians. I'm talking composers. I'm talking poets. I'm talking philosophers. I am talking playwrights. I am talking communicators. I'm talking journalists. Anybody is in the area of human communication. We need you. We need you to re-educate 7 billion people that have grown accustomed to a throwaway society to communicate what it's going to take to become a sustainable society. What does it mean to every human being on this planet to be part of a sustainable planet instead of a throwaway planet? We all know how to live in a throwaway society. This is darn easy.
Yes,
but living in a sustainable, on a sustainable planet where we somehow have to get 7 billion people cooperating and doing what nature does, recycle everything. Wow.
The possibilities are truly endless. So when you get people from all walks of life, we can start with one brilliant artist you bring up in your book, Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah.
That was his whole shtick, really.
Yeah. He says there's no such thing as waste. I mean, he was thinking of industry. He was thinking that each industry's waste product should become another industry starting material. And I think that is a case of where somebody is modeling an idea again on nature. And I think it's very intriguing that Leonardo seemed to start with nature. He would take the bird's wing and make a flying machine. Or, you know, he would look at nature. And he obviously looked at nature and realized that nature doesn't make any waste. And so stated as such, and applied it to whatever industries were going on at that time. Another thing I wanted to come back to is you talked about industry using the rank and file, using everybody in the industry from the chief executive officer, which reminds me of Anderson, Ray Anderson. He was the chief executive officer of Interface Carpet. He's died now a couple of years ago, but he inspired a lot of people. And he said, you know, when I read Paul Hawkins' book, The Ecology of Commerce, it was like a spear in my side. And I was determined then and there to make our company the first truly sustainable multinational corporation. But what he did was to enlist every single person in the company. He would say, I want to make progress in these fronts. And he spelled out 7 different areas where they wanted to become sustainable. Energy use, water use, material use, toxics reduction, or pollution reduction, etc. 7 areas. And he said to all the workers, I want you all to think of ways that we can achieve these 7 goals. And by the way, whatever savings we make based upon these 7 goals will be shared with all of you. You will share in whatever we save. And, of course, needless to say, he got tremendous cooperation from the rank-and-file workforce, tremendous pride in their company as a result. And the interesting thing is they saved money on every single thing. So every single thing that they did to do it right and to do better for the planet, they actually saved money for the corporation,
right,
which is an incredible message for the rest of industry.
Yes, money talks, and that's okay. It's a good inspiration if that's the inspiration of the moment. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you real quickly was the whole program, and I believe Al Gore set it up, about offsetting your carbon footprint. I mean, that's kind of like saying you can reuse all of your waste. I just could never get behind that program. And
well,
I was wondering
I've
what
never
you thought
understood.
About it.
I mean, I don't think it communicates this whole carbon footprint. I know it's important, but I think we've got to make it much closer to people's experience. And also be conscious of getting very positive feedback when people do things. I just don't like the pocket calculator approach. I've never been able to do it myself. I mean, calorie counting, for example. Never have had what it takes at the end of the day to calculate calories that I'm eating and so on. It's much better when my wife said, eat as much salad as you can. Eat as much as you can salad. And then when I found I was enjoying the salads, it made life a lot easier than counting calories. She says, if you eat salads, you'll lose weight, period. I need things simple. And I think if you were to visit a reuse and repair operation, I've mentioned Dan Knapp's Urban Ore in Berkeley. There's a Resource in Burlington, Vermont, Wastewise west of Toronto. All over the world, you'll find these wonderful reuse. Eric Lombardi's EcoCycle. EcoCycle. If you visit these places, you don't have to study them. It communicates itself. It wins the argument. You win, but just they will win by your just looking. I mean, the moment you step inside a reuse and repair center and you see the things which are going on, it's obviously the right way to go.
Yeah, you know,
and that's the kind of education we need, especially for kids.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, some good field trips.
Composting, worm farms, everything.
Yes.
All that stuff.
Yeah. Well, lastly, Paul, share with us maybe someone's dream or something you've heard about that hasn't quite made the mainstream yet, but that just is just so fantastic.
Well, I think that one of the dreams which is being shared around the world by a remarkable person right now is a guy called Paul Martinsson from Gothenburg in Sweden. You'll read about it in the book. They've got in Gothenburg, Sweden, which is not great, by the way, for waste management because they've built far too many incinerators. But here's a good example amongst the morass of bad things, of bad incinerators. They've got a reuse and repair and recycling park, and they've deliberately set out to make this the most enjoyable place to visit, a bit like going to a zoo, the kind of thing that you'd want to take your kids to. And I'll just give you a few examples. You walk in the reception area, there's a band playing. You go around, and there are clowns to entertain the kids, and kids' swings and, you know, those bouncy things and all the things they do for kids these days. And then when you go to the toilet, it's not a toilet, it's an art gallery. You're surrounded by paintings, secondhand paintings, which you can buy if you're so inclined, but meanwhile, you enjoy your poop or your pee or whatever. And then they've got this amazing dog, this separating dog. It can take mixed recyclables and separate into six different categories. And I think if a dog can do that in Sweden, surely most citizens on the planet can separate into three. They have rock concerts for kids. Their entrance fee is 20 PET plastic bottles to get them engaged. They're making secondhand fashions attractive with fashion shows. You name it. It is a fun place to go. People are learning. They're having fun. They're making money out of it with all the secondhand stuff. So I think that many people are familiar with a lot of this idea. There's a lot of wealthy people out there that change things, are willing to throw things away or at least discard them because now they're the wrong color or the wrong make or the wrong design or what have you, but they're perfectly usable.
Yes, yes.
And those reusable things can create jobs, train people, make money, help with poverty relief, etc. So that's just a very, very visible part of this whole process. But do remember, reusable objects are low volume, high value, whereas recyclables are high volume, low value. So it's not, doesn't make a huge dent in the actual waste stream, but it makes a huge contribution in the educational stream.
Yes. Well, Paul Conant, I think you are creating a good revolution here and resolution, and I thank you so much. And although there are so many that will remain nameless because there are too many people to really thank that are doing so much in this regard, we need to thank your wife, apparently.
Absolutely. Yes, she gets me into trouble most of the time. She was the one that got me involved with fluoridation. She was the one that that did Waste Not for 13 years and provided the information that they weren't getting from industry and weren't getting from the media by and large. So, yes. And as far as the book is concerned, this is a team effort. My name is on the title of the book, but it really was a team effort. Not only the 10 people that wrote the essays on zero waste at the end, who most of them know more about the practicalities and the economics of this whole thing than I do, but also throughout the book, especially when we get to the second section that deals with case studies of zero waste around the world, there the people from different countries helped me enormously. I can only go to so many places myself and recount what I have seen, but I needed that team to cover much more. Again, it's a team effort. We need a whole team, a whole planetary team here, which incidentally, of course, is a lot easier with internet today.
Oh, yes, yes. We've got a good jump on things, and your book is certainly one of those big, giant steps, and I thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Robin, for everything that you're doing.
Paul Conant's book, The Zero Waste Solution, great for the community, great for the individual. And thanks to everyone out there who I know are already doing a great part of service toward zero waste. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.